All right. Hello, everybody. We are here to talk about the Sphinx. Who built it? How it was built? What it was built with? And specifically, we're going to take a look at the geoarchaeology of it. And so I'm joined by Bob Schneiker, a geologist, and Dan Falou, a geoarchaeologist.
And you're also going to be joined by Super Sexy D, a.k.a. me, that hairy old dude that's... Hi, and welcome to the Donkey. This is Dan. I guess is one of my other names. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about Flint Dibble and Dan Falou and Bob Schneiker's take on the Sphinx. And as usual, my take is different. So I'm going to go ahead and lay that out really quick before we dive too far into this. I think that the natural outcrop of rock that the Sphinx was carved from was sacred in that area for a very long time. Tens of thousands of years, possibly. As long as people lived in the area and were watching the sky closely, because it faces due east. And a natural piece of rock that aligns so well to the sun is the kind of thing that many cultures have deemed sacred. And indeed, this, you know, this is the type of thing that you would see, like, that sky-ground dualism they talk about in sacred geometry that Hermeticism has made famous. I believe that that outcrop of rock was much larger at the beginning when it was first venerated, and then slowly over time it was carved down either by human hands or the elements or a combination of both, until eventually it barely was above grade, and that in order to keep it a sacred piece of bedrock as it was to begin with, that the ancient Egyptians dug it into the ground some. I believe there's a very good possibility that that outcrop of rock is the primordial mound that the Egyptians speak of in myth, or that they equated it with it as such, and that's why they kept it there. This primordial mound was so important to the Egyptians that they put it in the bottom of all these pyramids, a symbolic version of it. The Benben stone that was the top of the different pyramids, the Pyramidion, this also was a symbolic primordial mound. And I believe that the outcrop of rock that the Sphinx was eventually carved from may well have been that mound in Egyptian mythology. Now, I'm not sure when the enclosure was carved, as the data is contested on both sides of that, but I do believe that by the 4th dynasty it was carved in the shape of a lion to emulate Zeptepi, or the first time of Egyptian mythology, which is also heavily associated with resurrection in the afterlife. The Sphinx facing due east, being carved in the shape of a lion, does make it very compelling as an equinoctial marker intended to face Leo. I believe that originally it may well have been a lion's head, and that in the 4th dynasty, when the convention of putting a human's head on a lion's body became a thing in the royal family only, really, that maybe the Khafre or Khufu of the time was just like, you know what, man, all these lions around nowadays, we stick our heads on it. King Lion over there, King of Egypt, right? Put my head on that damn thing. All right, anyway, that's basically my position, and I could babble about this for hours. Let's continue the rest of the video.
The question that we're going to try to focus on as we answer a few along the way is actually, how old is the Sphinx? There are no contemporary inscriptions from it, but archaeologists are sure it dates to either Khafre or Khufu. The earliest mention of it is the dream stele found right by its paw, but that's from 1,000 years later, right? But the answer that archaeologists will all give you is it's the context of the site, right? The Sphinx is embedded within the context of a larger monumental landscape. And so that helps us understand, in particular, its spatial relationship, for example, to the pyramids of Khafre and Khufu, and the entire Giza necropolis itself. And we can, of course, date these pyramids and structures around the Sphinx. The Sphinx itself is difficult to get any radiocarbon from because it's carved out of the rock. There's nothing else there, but there's charcoal that's been found embedded in the blocks of the pyramids, in the Sphinx temple. All the radiocarbon dates date to approximately that time period.
Notice he's pinning the dating of the Sphinx on the dating of the pyramids and via context. And I understand that context is a huge part of archaeology, don't get me wrong. But there is a massive difference between something that's buried in the ground under undisturbed layers and then speculating that this building is related to that building, especially when one's not a building, it's just a carved piece of bedrock. You don't know when it was made. You really don't at all. You know when it was touched up last, stylistically, kind of, sort of. That's about the best you can do with that. You can't really say the Sphinx was built at the same time as the pyramids. Very easily, the pyramids could have been built around the Sphinx. As a matter of fact, if, like I say, that primordial mound was what the Sphinx was, it would totally make sense that they would build around that primordial mound. It would even make sense that they would rob some blocks out of that damn primordial mound in order to put in their pyramid or one of their temples or something, right? It would make sense, because that would be a very sacred chunk of bedrock. Even if it was crappy limestone, that's sacred crappy limestone, right?
But last of all, there's kind of a stylistic argument that archaeologists make. This Sphinx looks kind of like Khafre, Right. And so that's an important argument that we should not just throw out. But it does. I'm not sure if it necessarily proves anything. This must be Khafre instead of Khufu, for example. We don't have any real nice statues of Khufu, for one thing. But the other thing is the stylism in general. It could just be any pharaoh, because this is, for example, a statue of Djoser. And if you notice this headdress, people might say, oh, my God, if the Sphinx dates earlier, as Robert Schock argues, maybe the pharaohs copied the Sphinx's style. But the earliest example of a headdress is from the very first dynasty on this plate from Abydos. And so we know when this style started, and we know that the Sphinx is part of this style of Old Kingdom pharaohs.
Now, hang on, that headdress is old, yeah, but the convention of putting that head onto a lion's body, that's a Fourth Dynasty thing. That's all that family in the Fourth Dynasty, Khufu and Khafre and all those guys that are all related. It very well could have been a dynastic thing. And Flint knows one of the positions that guys like me hold is that the head may well have been recarved. So saying, well, look, that headdress is conventional type of headdress for the time. It's like, well, that, yeah, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't carved before that. That doesn't mean that at all. It just means that it was put on there at that time. And again, we know that that was started in the Fourth Dynasty. So it could have very well have been recarved at that point. It's not evidence against that position.
You talk to people on the internet or at sort of public outreach events, and everybody brings up this idea of this erosion of the Sphinx. What do you think about the erosion of the Sphinx? And they all point to the geologist, Professor Robert Schock. He's a professor at Boston University, and he presented a paper with John Anthony West. They argue that this erosion, the eroded surface, the weathered surface, proves that it's older.
Look at that. Usually the academics are the ones that have access to the info, and I have to go through all the trouble of searching for it, but this time, I'm the one that has access to the info, and these guys have to go looking for it, assuming that none of them own VCRs. Well, anyway, yes, that is the hypothesis that they have, is that basically that the Sphinx was weathered by erosion through water, and that would push the date back to the Green Sahara period, because you didn't have no water up until then. So they dated the Sphinx at around 10,000, 12,000 years ago in this video, if I remember right. It's been a minute since I watched it. Also, Charlton Heston has a lead role.
What about this specific argument sort of the weathering and the erosion drew you in to speak up and do some research?
Wow, that's a good question. I'm not so sure it was the weathering or the erosion. It was the realization that the archaeologists, the Egyptologists, probably know what they're talking about, and that it isn't older. And if you're going to instantly, as Robert Schock has, instantly jump to saying it was a lost civilization, I sort of felt like I was a doctor coming on an accident scene, and I needed to do what I could. So I think that probably more than anything explains why I started looking into it.
Now, this is one of the most telling clips in the entire video, and it also kind of showcases that people are people, man. It doesn't matter what side of the fence they fall on. Bob Snyker, the geologist, he didn't get involved in this because he found the geology interesting. He didn't get involved in this because he loved ancient Egypt. He didn't get involved in this because he was like, oh, man, I got some great new hypothesis about this that I think I know the answer. No, he did all of that after he decided, I don't like the association with Atlantis. I think the archaeologists probably know what's going on. How can I go fix this? I'm going to react to this like an emergency responder. His words, not mine. So him jumping on it like that, long story short, arguably any data that he found would have been used to undermine Schock's position.
So about every 20,000 years, the Sahara switches between desert and green savanna. And as I pointed out on that slide, there's like 230 of those that have been documented over the last 8 million years. So the people were living in the Nile Valley. Then during the Green Sahara, you can see in the center two slides, it's green. The people are living in the Sahara and they're not in the Nile Valley. And then as it returns to desert, then everyone migrates back into the Nile Valley. And that's when we have the Egyptian civilization being there. If anybody was there earlier, that would have been all washed away.
So people move back and forth in this region for thousands of years. All the while, there's this outcrop of rock that points right where the sun rises on the equinox. So as far back as people started watching stars religiously, this would have had religious significance. It would have been important, possibly, not necessarily, but quite possibly, quite easily. I mean, it's not a stretch to imagine them worshiping the sun, right? In addition to that, from the research I've done, it seems to me that there are several models for the flooding of that area, and not all of them involve the complete flooding of the Sphinx enclosure.
It's a question that I would really ask them, right? Where you see it says Pyramids of Giza, and you look at the Nile levels, and you see that there's a low spot right there.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I would ask is if, because it is, the Sphinx is in the Nile floodplain. So what advanced civilization, if somebody asked me where to put the Sphinx, I would say, don't put it there. You're putting it into the Nile floodplain. It's going to end up getting soaked on occasion, and that you've got the wicking groundwater that's destroying it. What were they thinking? That's one of the ways in which I would say you can help date when the Sphinx was made, because it was made during that period when there were lower levels on the Nile.
I think this has more to do with the fact that the Sphinx is made out of bedrock, sacred bedrock even. As I mentioned earlier, the bedrock was a big deal to the ancient Egyptians. They liked to put it in the bottom of their pyramids, right? So I don't think that they picked where to put the Sphinx. I think the Sphinx told them where to put it. This is the piece of holy sacred bedrock. This is the big boy. This is quite possibly the primeval mound.
And we have that data that shows that the highest level in like the 1880s, I can't remember, it was like 21.4 meters above sea level. And the Sphinx itself, the floor of the Sphinx excavation is at 20 meters. So that means the Sphinx was an island surrounded by 1.4 meters of Nile floods. And yeah, it's in the floodplain.
No, I hadn't heard this before, that the outcrop of rock that would later become the Sphinx would have been sitting on an island that you could have waded to back in the Green Sahara period. That is extremely interesting, especially if you know anything about the ancient Egyptian mythology and their creation myths. Your primeval mound coming out of the water, like I mentioned before. Imagine a rock that you could wade to, that you get on this island and you look due east on the equinox and it matches sky to ground and you're all like woo 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 with it. Back in those days, man, I could see that having a lot of significance. And considering that we know for a fact that the ancient Egyptians venerated the first mound coming through the water, I mean, this to me sounds like it makes it a very good candidate for what I'd already thought in the past. If you look, shameless plug, here's a short that I made a while back about how I think that there's a possibility that the Ben Ben Stone might have came from the Sphinx, that there was one of the rocks that were quarried out of there, and that was a sacred piece of ground, may well have been that sacred first mound. But this really, in my mind, really reinforces that. There's a great, that's perfect. It slides right in with Egyptian mythology and with what we know about that area, if you're a little bit of a pyramidiot like myself.
So one of the things that for me that, you know, Hancock and all those people always point out is that you've got the alignment. It runs east-west. So yeah. And then they say, well, it must align with Leo, which proves that, you know, at the sunrise, because that's what it's facing. But if you look at the Nilometer data, you'll see that the Nile rises in August. And so that is a tie into Leo, that you don't have to redate everything. It's not really my area. That's more, you know, the archaeologist, but I'm seeing that. And you have depictions in Europe of fountains and all over the Mediterranean with lions dispensing water. So I mean, look,
every time there's a lion that's facing eastish does not mean that it was built when the procession set it up so Leo was in that area of the sky. During the equinox, that's just belies belief. The Egyptians built many things facing north, south, or east, west. And this obviously is in relation to the pyramid itself.
Oh, the dismissal of archaeoastronomy. It's time to go on a rampage. No, I'm kidding, of course. But on a serious note, though, it's not surprising that archaeologists miss this. They are looking at the ground while astronomers are looking at the sky. But it does track that is a great lens to look at the ancient world through. The night sky, the sky period, makes up half of the visual experience of basically anybody throughout all of human history. Its predictability has been posited by many anthropologists as like the source of the concept of divinity. I mean, how many ancient cultures, their ideas of the afterlife involved the heavens? I mean, heaven, right? this is super ubiquitous. So to me, the dismissal of, well, you know, it's just, you know, facing due east. It's like, man, there's not an archaeoastronomer alive that will not tell you something facing due east is an equinoctial marker. That's the first thing, literally the first thing that they look for when they're looking for alignments is something that faces the rising sun on the equinox. But modeling a known zodiac constellation is a big deal. Now, I'm not saying that it was made back 12,000 years ago. I'm saying, like I mentioned earlier, that it was made to emulate Zeptepi, or the Egyptian first time, that they believed that that was the symbol that they should be looking at then. Now, earlier they were discussing context to date this stuff, and this is not archaeological context, but this is astronomical context. We know that one of the signs on the ecliptic is Leo, a lion, and we have a symbol. We have an outcrop of rock facing due east that would line up with that symbol on the vernal equinox, which is the time that the age of the era is named. It has been for like ever and ever and ever. So this isn't like out there and crazy woo to think that they would have expected this to line up with their Zeptepi sky. That totally makes sense given all of the data that we have. Again, if you're a little bit of a crazy pyramid idiot like myself. On a side note, y'all astronomers out there need to go out and buy a telescope and stand up and look at the night sky with it for a little bit. Just like experience that for a minute, even without a telescope. Just go out and get away from the light pollution and just look up at the night sky and think about it from the perception of somebody that this was the greatest show on Earth. This was amazing. This was something you'd never see anywhere else except for the night sky, and it's predictable, but it's awe-inspiring, and there are some parts of it that aren't predictable. And the same sky you see now is almost exactly the same sky they saw 50,000, 100,000 years ago. That's a lens that you can't really get anywhere else. You know, you don't eat the same rice they ate 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, but you see the same sky. And that, to me, is a huge deal. So what I'm getting at here is, even though I'm an atheist, and I know most of you scientist types are pretty skeptical too, if you really want to have a spiritual experience, go out there and stare at those stars and feel in touch with your ancestors for a minute. And then if you really want to throw some icing on the cake, think that there might be some goofy being staring back at you from those stars you're looking at too. And you can really go all Carl Sagan with it and have some spirity woo without getting all crazy with it.
And then, of course, they've done geochemical analyses of the stones themselves to sort of say which quarry different stones came from. And so we can tell that for the Pyramid of Khafre, they came from this eastern area right near the Sphinx, right? That's what the sort of markers sort of show, the chemistry of the stones themselves, just like what Dan described at Daskalio. They've done this here. They know where these stones come from, and it's right by the Sphinx.
Well, that doesn't actually mean that the stones came from the Sphinx enclosure itself. It just means it came from that vicinity, right? That's a pretty big chunk of ground there that it could have come from. So it's not exactly definitive.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just the difference between the where you see these sort of steps, which I understand the argument is that this is just like the ridge that runs under the Great Pyramid. This is just carved into relief to accept casing stones, right? Or bricks.
Without question. Well put.
And this is a technology we know. The Egyptians did this. This is how the Egyptians made cased and faced architecture. This is as Egyptian as brickwork is Roman.
Now, in my opinion, this is ignoring something very basic here. Why was it carved from bedrock? I mean, the ancient Egyptians made all kinds of statues, right? So why the hell did they carve the Sphinx here out of bedrock instead of just making a statue of whatever the hell they wanted? Because that bedrock was sacred, man. That's what I'm saying. I totally believe that that was a sacred site for a very long time, that stone was deemed sacred. So in my opinion, the original construction to this would have absolutely been working with the bedrock. It's only when you come along later, and just like us now, we're like, well, we have to use bricks to shore this up because there is no bedrock left. Only then do you actually start to use the casing stones. And in my opinion, they did it not because, like, we do it for preservation reasons. In my opinion, they were doing it for a sacred reason. This stone is sacred. We're not going to start burying this with other crap until we have to. Again, otherwise, they would have just put whatever the hell they wanted there, man. They'd make a big old statue out of cats. Apparently, they were really good at stacking blocks as high as they wanted.
Something interesting turns up when you look at the carbon dates from Giza, is that the that they did with the large radiocarbon study, the Middle Kingdom and the later dates fit very well to the known chronology, and they're very successive. The Old Kingdom dates are a little bit all over the place by a couple hundred years. Now, does this mean that the pyramids were all built at the same time? No, what it likely means is that there's an old wood effect going on, that there's use of wood that was all felled at a particular point in time, or even burned to make charcoal at a particular point in time. And then this is used throughout the next couple hundred years. And this is why, this is the best explanation as to why you have this localized sort of chaoticity in the radiocarbon record.
Those later pyramids are tiny compared to those that were built in the Fourth Dynasty, and the first pharaoh of the Fourth Dynasty had three pyramids attributed to him. So obviously there was something going on there as far as a multi-generational type of thing goes, in my opinion. The dude didn't die three times, right? Now, the old wood thing does explain to a degree why you have a problem dating these pyramids in the Fourth Dynasty so much compared to the pyramids later. But I would say that it's more likely that these are just multi-generational projects. The timeline all of a sudden becomes sensible if you just say, well, all right, you know, Khafre starts working on his sons and he starts working on his grandsons, he finishes his, and he gets about halfway done or two-thirds of the way done with his sons, for example. And this would also explain why the layout is quite frequently the subject of archaeoastronomers, including guys like Giulio Magli, who have nothing to do with Orion when he looks at it quite frequently. I'll put some links down below just for fun. To me, it seems far more likely that these were just built over the course of 60 or 80 years instead of 20 or 30 years, and that's why the wood is dated all a little bit off, because the Egyptologists are kind of looking at the wrong time.
We can speculate all we want on the kind of when these blocks were looted or not. But at the same time, we have very clear stylistic relative chronology evidence that shows the building of the pyramid. We have the clear evidence for climate change and the African humid period, which Schock does not mention in his publications on this, which should refute an earlier date to begin with.
I just want to point out that Schock actually is dependent upon the African humid period. He doesn't really call it that, but that's the evidence of the precipitation that he's saying. So he's saying, you know, you can't actually date the age of the Sphinx, but because it was eroded by precipitation, it must have existed during the African humid period, is basically what he's saying, although he doesn't use that term.
Wait a tick. So Flint doesn't even know that Robert Schock's position is based around the Green Sahara and the precipitation being the weathering agent for the Sphinx? Bob had to explain that to you? Would you like to borrow a VCR, sir? I have some that you could purchase for a low, low price.
So, yeah, I mean, there's so many assumptions being made here. And they're just assumed to be true, and then it's like this gotcha, see?
Yeah, it's reminiscent of somebody just asserting that the pyramids and the Sphinx were made at the same time, dating the pyramids, and then just claiming, hey, the Sphinx was made at that time. Gotcha.
But I've never heard of sort of like, let's date this monument from erosion. Like, that's just not how archaeological dating's done. We have large data sets, millions of radiocarbon dates from around the world. We now have uranium thorium dating. We have stylistic dating of thousands of potsherds. We have quantity that we use to date things, not just one exceptional example.
Well, with the exception of the stylistic dating, none of the things you just listed could actually work with the Sphinx. And again, if the head's recarved, well, then the stylism's out, unless you're going to say that lions were unique to Fourth Dynasty Egypt. But if you think the geology cannot be used to date something in an archaeological sense, I suggest that you pay a little bit of attention to the whole argument that Schock makes and the whole Green Sahara thing. It does have people coming out to try to undermine it, because they do recognize if that's water erosion, the Sphinx is going to have to at least be before the Fourth Dynasty. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. So in that regard, you can date things through geology.
Because this is all about you getting ready, in a sense, for the debate that's coming up in October.
To a certain degree,
and
yeah.
To a certain extent. And I want to point out that I actually shook hands with Randall Carlson in Mexican Hat, Utah, 2 years ago. And he agreed to go toe-to-toe with me, and I've never heard from him since. So I'm waiting for the debate
Randall, if you're listening, come on, let's do this.
Let's do this.
For those tempted, don't. Seriously. Flint's sick. Okay, now I know that the whole debate thing has the polarization going on big time, like Milo from Mini Minuteman mentioned, that's like champions fighting each other. Him versus Hancock, and in this case, it'd be Dibble versus Hancock, right? But the man is sick, okay? Now, I understand that there's some other people out there just like claiming that that's all BS and whatnot. Take the goddamn high road here, okay? We have every opportunity to look like assholes here or to look like real human beings. Now, you take the opportunity here and think about which one you prefer to be. I know which one I'd prefer to look like. But honest to God truth here, there's nothing to be gained from calling him out and to dragging him in through the mud. And he's sick. So by doing that, you're not helping his life any. So if you watch this clip and you're like, oh, ho, ho, God, no, just don't. Seriously, okay? Show the world that you can be better than that, that us pyramidiots can be better than that. Don't let certain brighter, less insightful people paint the world of pyramidiots out to be a bunch of assholes, okay?
I think everyone's a little bit different on the way they're approaching it. I think Graham Hancock is looking for an alternative story. Whether he actually believes this alternative story or not, I don't know. I think he just is trying to invent a really cool, in his mind, story that is plausible. Not that it's real, but that it's plausible. And then others, like, you know, Robert Schoch, really believes that he has evidence for a lost civilization. So you need to approach all of these people a little bit differently and how they, what they believe, because they're not all the same.
Yeah, preach it, brother. I mean, I think Hancock is honestly sincere in what he thinks about lost civilizations and stuff, but I do think that there's a huge difference and that it needs to be pointed out. It's one of the complaints that I've levied a couple of times against the academics that I see on Twitter and on YouTube and stuff, is that quite frequently they throw the baby out with the bathwater. As a matter of fact, the position that I've portrayed here, or the one, especially about the pyramids being multi-generational projects, is quite frequently met with the same kind of opposition as it would be if I said they were 10,000 years old. And quite frequently, I'm just told that I'm crazy, blah, blah, even though the carbon dating kind of supports my position, doesn't it? But I'm still going to get lumped in with all this other crap because, oh, well, you know, Egyptology is a whole science and I'm just some pyramidiot. So there is that going on. So I do appreciate, you know, the differentiation between one group and another. I mean, some of us think that aliens built the pyramids, and some of us think that high tech built the pyramids, and some of us think that it was spirituality that built the pyramids. Some of us think that it was Egyptians that built the pyramids, you know, and some of us think that it's okay to harass people when they're sick, and some of us don't. So, yeah, we're different. Thank you very much for watching this far. If you made it, you don't forget to click all the buttons down below. Thanks a lot. Seriously, don't go messing with Flint, all right? If you've got to argue with him about something, make it polite comments, have a discussion with him, and when he says that he's done, you know, if you have to leave one more comment to let him know your position, do it. But don't harass the man, okay? He's having a tough run of it right now. We don't want to add to that. We want to demonstrate that we can disagree without ruining someone's personal life. Thank you very much. Have a good night. Goodbye.